With compliments to Janis Joplin, you can sing along if you want. Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Friends all have Porsches, I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? I didn't get the tune right at the beginning of that. My apologies. The disciples were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles / Romans, and they will mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were among the first persons called by Jesus to follow him while they were sitting in their boats mending their nets, remember? And later nicknamed by Jesus the sons of thunder. Funny thing about the name Zebedee, it means God has given. So in a way, God gave James and John to Jesus. Anyway, along this journey to Jerusalem, James and John came forward to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Which is an amazing act of chutzpah on their parts. First, for their presumption that they could dictate to Jesus to do something they wanted, and second, what they would eventually ask. And you see, they had rushed forward to Jesus, who was showing his courage, leading the procession to Jerusalem, even in the face of what he perceived to be certain death. And Jesus, being Jesus, with either great restraint or great love or great wonder, said to them, "What is it you want me to do for you?" Like it must be some kind of minor favor, such as may they walk with him at the head of the procession, or would it be possible for them to stop a while so they could attend to their biological needs? Or could they be the guests of honor at whatever dinner they might be sharing that night? No, it would be nothing like that. They said to him, out of all that they had been hatching between the two of them on the road, and with great anticipation, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." I imagine silence for a while, only the sounds of footsteps and the quieter conversations behind them. But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking." For sure. It's really the words "in your glory" that are getting to me. On the other hand, the disciples were reportedly very anxious about Jesus' turn toward Jerusalem and his laying out everything for them. So isn't it understandable that even the brightest and best among the disciples, the most courageous and energetic and imaginative, might be trying to construct some alternate, some better, some more hopeful reality than the one Jesus had presented them? But you see, Jesus said, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" I think it might have been partly due to the figurative language Jesus used here, hiding the reality of the cup of suffering, that he spent the night on the Mount of Olives praying to God that he wouldn't have to drink. The duration of time of which James and John and Peter would be asleep, or hiding his coming experience of fire and pain that he would endure in his passion by calling it his baptism. It was this figurative language, surely, that enabled James and John to reply after they had confirmed the matter by glancing at one another. Yeah, we're able. Then Jesus said to them, most likely still with love and understanding and forbearance and likely some sadness, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism which I am baptized, you will be baptized. For you know, it is reported that all of the disciples, with the exception of John, died martyrs' deaths. Because just as Jesus knew that the authorities, both religious and civil, would not abide the movement that Jesus was starting and would sacrifice him for the sake of what they perceived to be civil and religious order, he also knew that those he had called to follow him and witness to the kingdom would also be persecuted. He reiterated this point several times. And then Jesus adds to the original point, but to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. Might not be necessary to overthink this matter of who would be prepared to be at Jesus' left and right hand, except to note that there were indeed two people beside him at his moment of glory, if you consider that moment of glory to be when Jesus hung on that instrument of torture and death called the cross. Yes, two people, two thieves, one who recognized Jesus for who he was, and the other not. This is not the kind of glory seat we usually think of, and not one that many of us would consider volunteering for. Which might give us even more understanding again for James and John, who manufactured their own prophetic versions of future events. On the other hand, when the 10 other disciples and others who had joined this particular caravan heard this, meaning not only what Jesus might have been saying to James and John as they kind of wondered what was going on at the front of the line, but also inferring what their initial request was, they began to get angry with James and John. These other disciples might have recognized the whole tone deafness of the matter, and now they were all within a veritable crisis within a crisis. A possible shipwreck on the way to the big shipwreck. So Jesus called them, probably stopped the procession, speaking in a loud voice for everybody to catch up to the group at the front, maybe asking them to sit down if that were possible, especially for Simon Peter, who probably was the angriest, was already well known for his hot head and impulsiveness. And Jesus said to them, with compassion, with gentleness, with the foretaste of the passion and the cup and the baptism, you know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. What a thrill to follow Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of humanity, the Child of God. What an honor to be counted followers of Jesus today, the great physician, the one who ushers in the realm of God, the great shepherd of the sheep. All of these we spell with capital letters, right? And yet Jesus might have said, please don't use capital letters with me. And if you really want to follow me to life and life overflowing, please put your shift key away for the time being, because nobody capitalizes the word slave or the word servant or the words give up their life. They are written in the lower case, like the words humility or forgiveness, or mercy, or good news. This is the way of Jesus. No matter how great our anxiety, or how inflated our ideas of glory and self-importance, or how strong our desire to be pure above others, or how insistent our pride, wanting to be right. Are we able to follow in this way?